welcome everyone back to the Second Court of Appeals. If we have any people who weren't here for the first argument, we're about to have our second of two arguments for the afternoon. And then after that, we're going to open up the auditorium for Q&A from anybody who would like to ask any questions about the process generally. Not about the outcome of either case, obviously, and the lawyers involved in both cases have been gracious enough to agree to stick around, and so hopefully we'll have an interesting discussion after we're through. So, I understand that everyone is ready, and thank you for your agreement to start a little bit early on the second case, which I will ask the court to call.
The court will now call Benny Louis Edwards versus the State of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Kerry Jensen will argue for the appellant. Mr. Bryce Perry will argue for the state.
Thank you.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. So this is a criminal case involving one count of a delivery of cocaine, controlled substance cocaine, between 400 and 800 grams. And then after a finding that individual enhancement was true, the jury assessed a punishment of 60 years. I'm going to go very quickly over the factual background because there's a lot to cover. So basically, Officer Davis was told that Edwards was dealing drugs. He went to observe him, kind of spy on him. He saw Edwards go to an adjacent lot, open up a trunk. He was there for about 30 seconds, and then he came back. And with that tip plus what he saw, he got a search warrant. However, that search warrant was not executed until 3 days later. Now, when they got there, they found less than a gram of cocaine in the house. They found just over 4 grams of cocaine in the trunk of this car, and they also found some marijuana in this car. Now, as they were approaching, they saw Pacifica driving away. They saw Pacifica, and in that Pacifica, they found a large quantity of marijuana. When they pulled up, Mr. Edwards, the appellant, was in the front yard. He was not in the house. And from that, the jury, and nothing, there were no drugs found on this person, but there was $900. So, the defense, well, he didn't. Now, the first two issues that we have, they go hand in hand. The first is the evidence was insufficient to support the conviction, and the second one was that whether or not his incriminating statements, unmerandized incriminating statements, were improperly admitted. And so basically, we contend that there was insufficient, given all the evidence, there was insufficient evidence to find him guilty. But even if there was sufficient evidence, there would not have been sufficient evidence had these statements been excluded like they should. So as far as the links go, there are list 14 non-exclusive factors that I think we all know by now, so I'm not going to go over them one by one. But the only links in this case was that Edwards was in front of the house at the time of the raid. He had non-exclusive access to the house and the car. He had $900 in his wallet, and his golf clubs were found in the trunk of the car. But there's also quite a bit of weight against it, and much more than there is weight for it. And the defense presented evidence showing that there were five other people mulling around that car near the trunk before the SWAT team arrived. There was no evidence that he owned the car. The car was put up as collateral for another defendant. And Edwards was in the front yard when the police came. It was closer to the house than the car. And people that were detained in the Pacifica for the marijuana were detained close to that car. And also marijuana was found in the trunk of the car, which would have linked them to the drugs that were in the car.
There was no evidence of people who were leaving the lot who were detained and arrested
not on his part.
Well, didn't he have recorded conversations between he and his bail bondsman that, where he told the bail bondsman that he had time for the car and he pledged his collateral?
Yes, he did.
Why is that not evidence that he was the owner of the car?
I misspoke. So, he had title, but he didn't have. He may have had title, or he said he had title, but I don't believe the title was produced at trial. But it was not exclusive. Several people,
You would agree that we don't have to find that he actually had ownership. We just have to find that he had actual access, actual control over either the premises where the drugs were found, or in this particular instance, the vehicle in which the drugs were found. If he had access, for example, to the front seat of the Cadillac, but didn't have keys to get into the trunk, or, you know, then maybe he could pop the trunk or something like that. But yes.
And I don't think that there's any argument that he didn't have access to the vehicle. The real thing is that he didn't have exclusive access to the vehicle, and that anybody could put the drugs in that car. If you look at McCraw versus State, which is out of your court, you know, there was an unlawful possession of a firearm case where the court found that the defendant didn't have exclusive control of the vehicle where the weapon was found, and the weapon was not in plain view, so that they found that there was insufficient evidence in that case because it didn't have exclusive control of the vehicle. And we're talking about a three-day difference here. There's testimony showing that other people were around that more recently than he was. So it's just, there aren't enough affirmative links.
Well, we have testimony, I'm not sure if it's from Davis or from somebody else, but he was surveilled conducting what they testified looked like a drug deal 3 days before the actual raid. So you're correct, there's a time differential. And that he had access to the trunk, that somebody came to the front of the home where he was, of the residence where he was. And then when they came to the home, he then went to the lot, opened up the trunk for about 30 seconds or so, closed it, came back, interacted briefly with the individual who had come to the home, and then that person left. Okay, which was the basis for the search warrant, based upon the testimony of those who were, the officers who were surveilling, that it looked like he was conducting drug deals from his home out of the trunk of the Cadillac.
Yes, and that would have been enough to get a reasonable suspicion search warrant to try to look at everything, but I don't believe any rational juror could find that. There are enough links there to find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt because of that, because it is 3 days later, because it was, you know, because of the someone else having marijuana nearby, because a neighbor saw different people around the car as well. It's the fact that he didn't have exclusive access to that, which
means there was another connection there, because when they did in fact engage in the search of the residence, they found a digital scale, they found razor blades, plural, and they found a razor blade with cocaine residue on it, all of which the officers testified would be evidence of dealing going on. And so there was no testimony about any of the other individuals who were around that car coming to the residence where that type of paraphernalia was available. Only he had that type of access to both the residence and to the Cadillac.
Right, and the residence and the Cadillac, you know, two different quantities of drugs were found in each of them, and I'll get to that in just a minute. But he was not the only person in the residence, if I recall correctly. You know, didn't have exclusive access residence either. He didn't own the residence.
Well, his girlfriend was there, and she had cocaine in her purse, which is not the basis of this particular prosecution, so you're correct about that.
I'd like to turn your attention and get you to explain about what happened when your client was in custody, had his Miranda rights read to him, and underwent what you characterized as an interrogation. So talk to us some about that situation.
Thank you, I'd like to. The defense's whole case relies on Innis. And Innis sets out the standard for whether or not conversation or an interrogation, whether conversation is an interrogation. Now, the standard is any words or actions on the part of police that we should know are reasonably likely to elicit the incriminating response from the suspect. And of course, we argue that it did at this point. Now, the should have known test, it focuses primarily on the perceptions of the subject rather than the intent of the police. And that's from Alford versus State.
So is it your position that engaging in, as I understand it, your client and the officer were having a very spirited discussion about the upcoming election between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, your position is that engaging in that sort of conversation would tend to elicit an incriminating statement about the defendant's possible drug dealing?
Yes, I believe that it's a known interrogation tactic to become friendly with an accused in order to get them to open up to you. And that is an interrogation tactic.
So at that point, any friendly conversation when someone's in custody becomes an interrogation?
No. It's fact specific, very fact specific. But in this case, he was sitting in the booking room with this police officer for hours. And it got so animated that other police officers had to come in and ask if everything was all right.
And it was animated about what?
It was animated about the debate. But
about what? About the election, right?
Correct.
So how is that animated discussion about an election going to be anticipated to lead into a discussion about the hidden question?
That's not the standard. The standard is not the intent of the police. It is the perceptions of the suspect under Alford versus State. Now, I want you to think about this. Think about it from appellant's perspective. You're sitting in a booking room with a police officer. You're isolated, and it's a completely police-controlled environment. You are having a casual conversation about the debate. You're feeling a little more comfortable. And then you ask a question. It's like, well, how did you tie me to the drugs in the car? And the police officer.
But the cases say that if the accused initiates the conversation with a question, that's not an interrogation, right?
Well, the case law says that it does say that, but this is different than most cases because as soon as the police officer said, because I saw you dealing drugs, remember, this is from the perceptions of the suspect. As soon as the police officer said, because I saw you dealing drugs, you know, if it wasn't an interrogation before, it's an interrogation now. Because from the perspective of the subject, the perception of the suspect, if you're sitting there and a police officer is saying, I saw you do it, and you think he's lying, what would anyone do? They would defend themselves with statements. And he just happened to make an incriminating one, saying, well, I don't feel drugs out in the open. So he was animated, he was excited, he asked just a simple question, and then the police officer interjected the facts of the case as, I saw you dealing drugs. And so what anyone would do, he would try to defend he defended himself poorly. But he was trying to defend himself because he was being interrogated.
But the officer didn't respond to the question. The officer made a statement. So then because the accused goes on to make a statement in response, it all of a sudden becomes an interrogation.
Do you have a case that says that? Well, yeah, Miranda. Okay. Miranda does. Miranda says that it is the words or actions, it's not questions or actions, the words or actions of the police And his words are, "I saw you do it." If I tell you, "I saw you commit a crime," what am I expecting you to say in response?
"I want a lawyer."
That's what you should say, yes. But that's basically it. This was an interrogation from the perceptions of the suspect and their outburst.
It's not a violation of the Constitution for law enforcement to create a situation where the accused will let their guard down, is it?
Well, it's not a violation of the Constitution to create that situation. It's a violation of the Constitution to create that situation.
Basically, it is saying it depends on how you create that situation.
Right. It's not a violation of the Constitution to do that. It is a violation of the Constitution to do that.
In your briefing, we haven't seen anything with regard to the unique facts of this case, which is an argument about Trump and Clinton. Okay. We've never seen anything like that, so that's unique. But are there any cases dealing with a situation where there is an interaction of this nature, a conversation going on in this nature, where a court has decided this type of conversation is not coercive because it's mere conversation, versus this type of conversation is coercive because it's, under the circumstances, it's effectively evoking a response?
You can take a little time to answer the question.
Nothing directly on point, but McCrory versus State, this was the case where two police officers were talking to each other, saying, you know, where's the gun in this case? We need to look here, we need to look there. And that was found to be...
But because it wasn't directed to the accused, it was not found to have created a coercive situation that violated the Miranda.
Correct. Yeah, but this is different. This is different.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Perry?
Defendant knows that he arrested him, and we're going to sit here for a couple, two, 3 hours and just have a nice conversation about politics. But in the meantime, somebody who is in custody, under arrest, for a crime, who really probably wants to know what's going on, asks a question about why do you think I had anything to do with the Cadillac? And then he says specifically, well, because I saw you selling drugs from that. Okay? Why is that not, just like under the rules of evidence, if I accuse you of a crime and you don't deny it, that's admissible as an admission by a party opponent. Silence can be an admission by a party opponent. Now here it would have been the right thing to do, but it's still, that rule recognizes that there's some type of reaction being invoked ordinarily under those circumstances. And here he's responding to the exact type of accusation that's recognized by that rule. Why should we not think that that is evoking or eliciting as contemplated by Innes?
And if I could just understand the court's question with respect to that, does the court, do you mean, Your Honor, that the political discussion is what's evoking the incriminating response, or that
I'm talking about the fact that even if they never had a political conversation, they could have been talking about the weather for all the concern. Is the man that arrested him is sitting with him for 2 or 3 hours and basically arguably inviting questions about why he's here. Okay? And that's exactly what these questions were. What do you have? Why did you do what you did? And that once that eventually got evoked by the accusation that you were dealing drugs out of that Cadillac, why is that not a coercive situation given how we treat those types of responses under the rules of evidence in terms of silence can be an admission against him?
And Your Honor, my answer to that question is that under the case law, a voluntarily given confession, a voluntarily given incriminating statement, the case law describes that as an unmitigated good. What's bad is when the incriminating statement is made through compulsion. The touchstone of the Fifth Amendment is compelled self-incrimination. And in a circumstance where an officer is speaking to a defendant, whether in custody or not, about the weather, there's cases cited in the state's brief where they're talking about football or an industry, or there's another case cited in the state's brief where they're talking about their families or religion. In those circumstances, when they're talking about unrelated topics, and it's then, as in this case, the defendant who steers that conversation towards the back to the defense, there's no compulsion. It doesn't hit that touchstone of the Fifth Amendment, and that's the reason that Miranda doesn't apply. They're voluntary statements. They're not given under compulsion. That's what the Fifth Amendment
is. Why should we not consider this to have been a willful refusal to Mirandize a criminal defendant and then using someone who was involved in the arrest? This isn't another officer who had nothing to do with the arrest, presumably has no idea what the basis of the investigation was one way or the other, just shooting the breeze with the criminal defendant. This is somebody that he was arrested by at the scene, okay, saw what was going on, presumably, reasonably infers, this officer knows why I was arrested, and then given 2-3 hours of sitting with that individual, and basically it's a curiosity kill the cat type of technique. So we're just going to set up a situation where the curiosity is just going to overcome the criminal defendant under those circumstances, and we're going to set it up by not Mirandizing it to begin with.
So, Your Honor, I have a factual and legal answer to that question. The factual answer is that argument is made throughout the appellant's briefing in this case. That this was a long game strategy to sit with the appellant and talk about unrelated matters to butter him up to make incriminating admissions. But there was only one witness in the trial court who testified about any of the facts of this conversation, and that was Officer Davis. And his testimony was that that wasn't the purpose of what he was doing there. He testified on reporter's record 6, page 80, that his purpose in discussing this matter of politics was not at all related to engineering incriminating emissions. He just characterized it as an enjoyable conversation.
Was there any testimony with regard to why it was Officer Davis that was chosen to babysit Mr. Edwards for 2 or 3 hours?
There's no testimony about necessarily what the policies of the Wichita Falls Police Department are with respect to who sits with it and as they're being booked in. I don't recall that in the record.
But Davis, the record does reflect Davis as part of the arresting, part of the raid, part of the search, and was part of the arrest of Mr. Edwards at the residence.
The record does reflect that. He was one of the officers who was conducting surveillance at the time as well. To give the further legal answer to that question of Your Honor, I would point this court to the case of Illinois versus Perkins. And that's a case cited in the appellant's brief, but I think it weighs heavily here. And in Illinois versus Perkins, what had happened was an officer, an undercover federal agent, posed as an inmate in a jail, in a cell. And it's decided as 496 U.S. 292, a Supreme Court decision from 1990. But the agent poses as an agent in the cell. And the question was, is Miranda required in that kind of circumstance when an agent poses undercover and pretends to be an inmate? And the Supreme Court said no, that Miranda was not required there. And there's a couple of quotes that I'd like to give the court as some reasoning for that. The court said, fidelity to the doctrine announced in Miranda requires that it be enforced strictly, but only in those types of situations in which the current concerns that powered the decision are implicated. And then went on to say, and this is the critical quote, I think, from that case as it applies here, ploys to mislead a suspect or lull him into a false sense of security that do not rise to the level of compulsion or coercion to speak are not within Miranda's concerns.
But isn't the factual circumstances there materially different? Because it's a undercover person who the criminal defendant doesn't know is a police officer and has no reason to suspect is a police officer and is free to talk to him, versus a situation like this where the person who's talking to is a police officer, he's in custody. That seems to be a much more compelling situation than an undercover agent.
There's certainly a factual difference between that case and this one, but I think the key part of this case, though, is that this political discussion would not in and of itself have evoked any incriminating emissions. A political discussion reasonably evokes political sentiments or political opinions, not incriminating emissions. Neither does a political discussion evoke a transitioning from that discussion to the facts of the offense. But what happened in this case is that during the course of the political discussion, this is Officer Davis's testimony, it's undisputed because he's the only one who testified about the facts of the offense, that it was Edwards who then steered the conversation away from politics towards the offense, and Officer Davis merely answered Mr. Edwards' questions about the offense. And under the cases cited in the state's brief, an officer's answers to a defendant's questions do not comprise interrogation. And the rationale for that, again, is that compulsion is the touchstone under the Fifth Amendment. And when it's a defendant who moves the conversation towards the offense, and the officer is merely answering questions about the offense, there's no compulsion.
Here, the actual answers, and the reason I'm talking about this silence is an admission against interest situation, is because when he said, well, I saw you doing this, well, the first big incriminating statement is, well, I never sell drugs in the open, okay? Which, from the standpoint of the defendant, is actually intended to be an exculpatory statement, not an incriminating statement. He doesn't realize it's an incriminating statement because he's saying, I sell drugs. He thinks it's exculpatory because it says, I don't sell drugs in the open. Okay? Same thing with part two, but I saw you get into the trunk. And he said, well, I was getting in there to check and make sure my golf clubs were still there. So again, what's intended to be an exculpatory answer in response to what is effectively an accusation by the officer, okay, which ends up being inculpatory because he knows what's in the trunk and so, and makes it absolutely clear that he knew what was in the trunk. So again, this is a situation where the conversation would not occur but for the fact that the officer was part of the arresting team and then was left with the defendant without ever Mirandizing this defendant for hours in a conversational mode.
And Your Honor, I guess part of my response to that would be that there are many occasions where this could, this very same transaction, beginning down the path of talking about something unrelated to the offense, whether it's politics or religion or something else, and the defendant transitioning the conversation to the offense, that could occur in a patrol car ride on the way to the jail. It could occur upon the execution of the search warrant as the defendant's being arrested and being put into the patrol car. The officer under Miranda doesn't require an officer at the moment of arrest to have a clean break of any interaction with the defendant whatsoever.
But my point is you are correct. The defendant initiates the conversation about the arrest, okay? But it's the accusation that he responds to with the inculpatory statement. Why is that not an interrogation? Because it's an answer to a question?
Well, that's...
The officer could have said, look, I can't talk to you about it. But he didn't. He said he told him and made the accusation. And both of those statements that were in response to the question were accusation.
And Your Honor, I think the officer could have said, I don't want to talk to you about it. But the officer wasn't legally required to say that because that's not the standard under Miranda. The standard under Miranda is interrogation and compulsion. Isolation, intimidation, compulsion, all of those are components of interrogation under Miranda, and none of those happen here. The officer could cut off the conversation, but it's not a legal requirement for the officer to do so, and that's why there's no interrogation here. And Your Honor, the two incriminating statements, as you mentioned, are the statements of, I don't sell drugs out in the open, with the implication being he does sell drugs in private, and the statement of there's golf clubs in the trunk with the implication, I suppose, being that he knows what's in the trunk of the car. But those two statements were rendered harmless, I think, beyond any dispute whatsoever by his unobjected to statements made in the jail calls when he was speaking to his girlfriend about what had happened with respect to the search. He told her that he knew that there was cocaine in the car, not just golf clubs, or not just knowing that there's certain items in the car. He tells her during those calls, I know that there's cocaine in the car. And she says, they're arresting you for more than 4 grams of cocaine. He says, that cocaine came from that car. And then further, they're in that conversation, those recorded jail calls, which he didn't object to. They start talking about the surveillance that Officer Davis had conducted. And she speaks to him in those calls about the fact that he had been selling drugs previously. And he admits during the jail calls that he had sold the drugs to the informant that had led to the execution of the search warrant and had used a derogatory name that I won't repeat to refer to that informant. But those, what was made implicit in the statements to Officer Davis that he may know of drugs in the car because he knew golf clubs in the car and that he might be selling drugs, those matters were made absolutely explicit in the unobjected to jail call. So even if there was error, which I think Miranda forecloses that in cases that come after Miranda foreclosed that, but even if there was error, there can't be harm given the admission of the unobjected to jail calls.
Well, he actually talks, those statements actually talk about a red Cadillac as opposed to a maroon Cadillac. Was there anything in the record developed one way or the other as to by the defendant or by the state as to why the jury could understand those telephone calls and could be referring to what everybody conceded was a maroon Cadillac as opposed to something being described as a red, not
don't apologize to me for that, Your Honor. But I think the answer to your question is the context of their conversation. He tells Dorothy Green, his girlfriend, she speaks to him first about the fact there's cocaine in a car, and that cocaine is the cocaine that he's being arrested for. And then he says the police are going to find some coke in that car, the one that the police had searched. He said, I won't be convicted for that dope because that car doesn't have my name on it. And then he says that he recognizes that the 4 grams of coke had come from that car. That's from State's Exhibit Number 30 at about 7 minute to 9 minute and a half mark of that conversation. So the context of the conversation is that he and Dorothy Green are speaking about the particular car that the police had searched and found cocaine in. He denies that the cocaine was his at that moment, but he recognizes that that's where the cocaine came from, and then he recognizes that he's a drug dealer and said that he had sold drugs to an informant who he referred to as.
We don't have a camera here that learns red and blue, right?
I'm sorry.
And that was a reference back to the previous argument.
Okay. But with all of those things being said, I think if there was error, and I don't think there was here, but if there was error, it was harmless. I would like to transition just briefly in my remaining time to talk about the preservation part of the third issue and the Williams case, which talks about the judge protecting, litigant protecting, sandbag rationale of the preservation requirement with respect to lesser included offenses. And the reason that we have a preservation requirement as to lesser included offenses is that there's a prejudicial nature of reversing a trial court for not giving a lesser included offense based on reasons that are articulated for the first time in the appellate court that were not articulated in the trial court, and when the trial court's articulation was insufficient to give the trial court any rational basis for giving a lesser included offense. Remember that a lesser included offense has to be a valid and rational alternative to charge offense. And in this case, the articulation in the trial court for Mr. Edwards about why he wanted a lesser included offense was essentially that there were 2 sets of drugs. He said, at this time, Judge, we request there be an additional lesser included offense of possession of less than 1 gram. He said that the possession of less than 1 gram was found in the house, that there was more than 4 grams found in a different location in the trunk, and he said potentially the jury could come back and determine that maybe he possessed the less than a gram in the house and didn't possess the one in the trunk. In other words, there were 2 sets of drugs found in different places, and maybe the jury could find him guilty of one and not the other. And that rationale for a lesser included offense didn't give the trial court any reason to submit an instruction that rationality offers for the first time on appeal is vastly different. So I'd ask the court to overrule his third issue along with his remaining issues and to affirm the trial court's judgment.
Thank you.
May it please the court, opposed to counsel. Let me go backwards here. As far as the harm that issue 3 and not being preserved, I think anybody in the judge's situation would know that he wants the lesser included offense because Peter carries a lesser punishment range. I don't think that has to be explicitly said. It's just something that every judge knows. And what other reason would there be to include a lesser included offense? So I believe that should be implied.
That's not being used as a compromise. It's supposed to be a separate, distinct offense. That the evidence supports that can in fact be the only offense. So here, that the only offense would have been that he was in possession of the approximately 1 gram of cocaine found in the residence. But there was no articulation of why that was a separate and distinct crime that was proved separately and distinctly, i.e. that was unique with regard to that and him vis-a-vis the Cadillac.
Unless I'm mistaken, the indictment just had the location and the date and time of where it possessed it, which could have included both the house and the car, one or the other, or neither.
How do you respond to, this was not argued, but it they would have found the one gram of mere possession as opposed to possession with the intent to deliver?
Well, my response to that would be the that's just one of the factors. There's all these other factors, and I'm running out of time, so I want to go back to issue two real quick, just to respond to some things that the state's attorney brought up. First of all, he made the claim that there wasn't isolation and intimidation, and I don't believe that that is correct. He was in a police booking room being completely subjugated in that way by the police. He couldn't leave. He was isolated. He wasn't around anyone else other than Davis, as evidenced by the testimony that other police officers had to come in to see if he was okay once he started yelling. Also, I believe you correctly said that he wasn't undercover, and that goes back to the perception of the defendant, because if I'm talking to a cop that's undercover and I don't know they're a cop, then my perception is that he's not a cop. You know, this is not whether or not the police intended to get around Miranda by doing some bad things, but it has to do with the perception of the defendant. And, whether or not the Davis testified that that wasn't the purpose for the discussion, that's irrelevant. That is just completely irrelevant.
Because why is this not harmless in light of his conversation with his girlfriend, which was recorded at the jail?
Well, that has to go with the standard for harm on failing to Mirandize. And under Phillips versus State, if any or all of the admissions have more than a slight effect, then the error is not harmless beyond that. So what he said to the police officer what he said to his girlfriend was not 100% cumulative of what he said. He said different things to Davis as he said to the girlfriend. And so because of that, it had a slight effect. Or it could have had a slight effect. So therefore,
it could have sufficient.
Well, it is. I mean, that's the standard. If any one or all of the admissions have more than a slight effect, then the error is not harmless.
How do we figure out that having a slight effect as opposed to could have?
Common sense. I mean, just if he's saying these things and the jury believed it, it's had a slight effect. And I don't think the jury could have not taken that into consideration.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your oral argument. Your case is submitted. I'll just stay here if that's all right.